I'm Dr. Rob Califf, and it's great to be here with you again at the American Heart Association's meetings in Los Angeles. It's been a while since we've been in Los Angeles, but I have the real privilege of being here with Bernard Gersh, a good friend and preeminent cardiologist from the Mayo Clinic. And as all of you know, these interviews for me are a real delight because we have a chance to learn about what makes people tick. And hopefully for those of you who watch this, it's a chance for you to think about your own lives and careers and what might motivate you to be a leader like Bernard. So, welcome and glad to have you here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure's mine, Rob. Thank you.
So you come from a very different background than me. I guess you could say we both come from colonies of the British Empire at one point or something. But
well, strictly speaking, I did come from a colony. I was actually born in Johannesburg, South Africa, but that's because my mother was from there. I actually grew up in Zambia, which was the colony of Northern Rhodesia, and the reason I was born in South Africa was there were very little medical facilities where we lived. It was really quite a primitive colony. She went down to Johannesburg for the birth. So I actually grew up in Zambia, but like a lot of kids, if you wanted a good education, you got sent away. So I was sent away to South Africa at the age of about 11 to prep school and then high school, and subsequently I went to university there. But the choice was very simple. You either went to South Africa for your schooling or you went to England, but you went to boarding school. That was.
If you trace your family back several generations before your parents, what was the history there?
They came out of Lithuania. My father, late father, who only died about 10 years ago, was actually born in Jerusalem in 1906. But they were moved back to Lithuania. And then when my father and his brother were little boys, they'd lost their father who died. Two of my great uncles had gone out to South Africa about 10 years before. They were very interesting guys, very tough guys, and they then went up to what was Southern Rhodesia in those days and ultimately became Rhodesia and Zimbabwe. And they worked in the cattle ranching business and trading stores on the Zambezi River, and really quite an exciting lives they led in the bush. They then came and brought my father out and his brother when he was about 6 years old. And they went to Cape Town, and then he left when he was about 16, 17 and joined them up in Rhodesia. So both parents came from Lithuania.
And what did your father do for a living? I think it was a...
He was a businessman. In the broader sense, he was a self-made man, built a really, at least for that little colony, a really big business. He was in cattle ranching, he bottled Coca-Cola, assembled Land Rovers, had an engineering works that made ball bearings for the copper mines, because copper mining was the main industry.
He was
there.
A diversified...
Very diversified guy, and he was way ahead of his time. I mean, 30 years ago, he set up pension schemes for black employees. People didn't think of that in the colonies. He designed an office building with sort of a version of solar power.
And what about your mom?
My mom was a nursery school teacher in Johannesburg. She was the youngest of a family of nine. And my mom only died a year ago, actually. Age 95, and she married my dad and went up to Northern Rhodesia in the late 1930s. And it was quite a shock for her because the town we lived in was really a mining town. It was a tough place. It was a lovely place to grow up, but when she went there, it was really a small town inhabited by a pretty rough bunch of miners, and she stuck it out, and she was... my father also got involved politically in the affairs of the colony. She was very much his partner in a lot of ways.
It's hard for me to even imagine what a mining town there would have really been like.
When I was a kid, it was already quite a large town. And in fact, it became the second city in the colony. My dad was the very first mayor of that city of Kitwe. It was Zambia's a beautiful country. It's got a lot of bush, but very attractive bush with a lot of wildlife. The town, very well, very green, as I remember it. Great sporting facilities, which the mines provided. And we actually weren't part of the mining community. We were in the residential private community. I used to be able to ride my bike 8 or 10 miles to the polo club and get on my horse and go ride through the bush with people and come back and ride my bike home. It was completely safe, you know, at the age of 8 or 10. But I think when my parents arrived there, it was really, there was very little.
So you went to, I guess, boarding school in South Africa. Was it all boys or?
All boys. I went to a prep school for 2 years in Johannesburg, and then a college called Hilton College, which is a magnificent school, about 50, 60 miles from Durban, which is on the east coast of South Africa. And the school was started in 1870. And had its own farm. It was on about 30, 40,000 acres of hilly river, hilly country with waterfalls and rivers. And it was a great school, but very isolated. I mean, there was, I think there were times the nearest girls' school was 4 miles away, and anyway you could get there, you could run there. But it was, it is a beautiful school, but it was all boys. And I'm not sure if it's co-ed now, maybe.
What was going through your mind with relation to apartheid and all that during those years? None of us choose the circumstances we're born into.
Yeah, when I was at school and at university, I actually felt and considered myself a Rhodesian, not a South African. I mean, I learned to speak Afrikaans fluently. We all had to do that. But I found it very disturbing. Now, in retrospect, it was there in the colonies too, but it wasn't so overt. There wasn't the, maybe the racial issues in a colony like Northern Rhodesia were more almost benign neglect, but the legislation of apartheid and the way it was enforced, I think I found very disturbing. Not I think, I did. Also in can't remember exactly when it was. It was probably in the 60s. Zambia, or the old federation of Northern Rhodesia, Southern Rhodesia, and Nyasaland, split up into Rhodesia, Malawi, and Zambia. So Zambia was an independent country with black leadership. So the rigid apartheid and divisions in South African society were troubling and disturbing. I wasn't an activist. I think I was probably still very much middle of the road, but I did find it disturbing.
So you left to go to university. How did that happen?
I was in my final year at school and didn't really know what to do, other than I loved playing rugby and cricket and squash and all the things we did, which was a very good sporting school. And about 3 months before I left school, I developed a viral illness. I'm not sure what it was, but there was a lot of polio around at that time, and they were concerned about that. But I don't think it was that. I couldn't move and all, but it was painful. It wasn't the painless paralysis of polio. But I ended up literally playing rugby on a Saturday, and on a Sunday night I was in hospital in Pietermaritzburg, which was about 20 miles away. And I spent the next 4 to 5 weeks there. And then when I was going through rehab, I thought, maybe I'd like to do medicine. I thought this was pretty cool, these guys walking around in white coats, you know, with a whole bunch of nurses training after them. And so I went to Cape Town University to medical school, where I had an extremely checkered career. It'll come out sooner or later. But I failed my first year miserably. It was the first.
You were playing at that time.
I was playing very hard. It was the first time since I was 10 that I wasn't in a boarding school. The freedom. I enjoyed the freedom, and I enjoyed living in the Cape. And in those days, they were much more lenient. I was allowed to repeat the year.
Wow.
Which you wouldn't know. I would have been thrown out. And then the second year, which was anatomy and physiology, we have a 6-year medical career. I nearly did the same thing again, and I was very, very lucky to get through that year. And then I did have a wake-up call.
What was the wake-up call? What happened?
First of all, we were ranked from about 1 to 122 in the class, and I got tired of being 121. More seriously, I had a very close friend also from Northern Rhodesia who was killed in a car accident, partying. I wasn't there. Got called in the early hours of the morning, and had to go identify him. He was in hospital then. But it was, and then he died, and it was a wake-up call. Just, and I do remember the following year, we had the mid-year results, and we all went up to look at the results on the board, and someone was walking away from the board, and they said to me, "It's been a terrible mistake." And I looked, and I was number one. And I never left that ranking again. So I really did wake up.
That's fascinating. So you went from Playboy, bottom of the class, to number one.
Yeah, I think there's still some people who...
You know, you wonder what... You know, some people go through life and never get the wake-up call, and others...
Well, I did, and I did.
So you finished medical school then in good stead, and what...
I finished medical school, and in my final year, I was, even though I'd repeated a year, I was still young. I mean, I was 22, 23. And a couple of people suggested that I apply for the Rhodes Scholarship. And I did, and got shortlisted. And I remember in the interview, the chairman of the Rhodes Scholarship, and at that time, it was a Rhodes Scholarship for, quote, the old federation of the two Rhodesias and Iceland. And it usually went to Rhodesia or Southern Rhodesia, which is a much bigger, had a much bigger population. I do remember the chairman of the selection committee looked at me, and he had a glint in his eye, and he said, "You have a very unusual CV for someone." And for someone who's a finalist for the Rhodes. And he said, "Have you got anything more to tell us since you were shortlisted?" And I said, "Well, I've just graduated." And he smiled and he said, "We got the results." And I'd won the class medals. And he had just a glint in his eye, and he said, "Now, why did you fail first year?" I said, "I partied too much." And then they gave it to me. Because a little bit unexpectedly. So I went to Oxford. Had one of the greatest times of my life.
You had some famous classmates, right?
I have Bill Clinton, President Clinton. But I have to say, I never met him the entire time I was at Oxford.
Wow.
First time I met him was at a Rhodes Scholars reunion. But I didn't meet him there. And a lot of the American Rhodes Scholars knew him, but we did overlap, but not totally. I think there was about a year of overlap.
So the way it works is you basically are in a college and you have your own
course. You do. We were all postgraduates. I mean, most of the Rhodes were, all of them were postgraduates. So I lived in a college, but I actually did a PhD. The idea of entering into the undergraduate system again with a tutor didn't work. I mean, I'd already done my internship. And an internship in Cape Town, Critters Care Hospital, is really quite, it's pretty rigorous. You know, you grow up quickly, as you will know, in any inner city hospital. But so I did a PhD, but I was able to continue to play rugby and cricket and sport. And there was a wonderful club at Oxford called Vincent's. It takes up about 120 members. You have to represent the university at one or other sport. And that's where we really lived. That's where we had dinner every night. 50% of us were postgraduates. We liked the English. I loved Oxford. It was just 2.5 great years, and then I went back to Cape Town.
What did you do your PhD on?
I actually did it in the Department of Anesthesia. And the thesis is called, I think, Hemodynamics During Anesthesia in the Dog. And what it was I was interested in looking at Vmax and, quote, contractility, the mythical
right.
Index of Contractility, and the senior lecturer in the Department of Anesthesia, who became a famous anesthesiologist in Britain, Cedric Priest-Roberts, was setting up an animal lab, and he wanted to look at the depressant effect of the anesthetics. So basically what we did was we used halothane as a model, and I looked at contractility, and he was looking at it from an anesthesia standpoint. So it was stressful, actually, coming from a clinical environment into the Oxford. The Oxford PhDs, at least then, you were really a little bit on your own. I mean, they gave you a lab and said, go and do your project. I think our PhDs are much better monitored, yeah. Mentored, at least.
Who had the biggest influence on you during your Oxford time?
During my time at Cape Town, it was the late Dr. Bal Schreer who started the cardiac clinic, and probably in the late 50s, and Chris Bonnard. And Cape Town was a powerhouse in clinical cardiology then. I mean, huge volume of papers were published. He influenced me to become a cardiologist. I think I learned very early on that I really wasn't going to be a biochemist, but I could understand the heart. At Oxford, I'd have to say that Priest-Roberts was a very good mentor. Amongst other things, what he really taught me was to present. I found that the difference between a lot of the South Africans and the Americans I met and the Englishmen I met is they were very at home presenting. For me, it was an incredible ordeal. I remember the very first abstract I presented, because the South African system was, you know, I see this in my own twin daughters born and schooled in the States. They're encouraged to get up and talk. You know, what are you going to tell the class today? We were encouraged to sit down and keep quiet. And so it was really an ordeal for me, and it was only after about maybe a dozen abstract presentations that I realized, gosh, I quite enjoy this. But he taught me a lot. He taught me how to write, too. So he had a big influence. The other thing that had a big influence on me was I made a host of lifelong friends during those days at Oxford, both English colonial and from the U.S. And we all still stay in touch.
That's really...
I think the... my wife had a very nice comment. She came with me to the Rhodes reunion, and at the time I was at Oxford, I was married to my ex-wife, at least for part of the time, because the first year as a Rhodes Scholar you couldn't get married, you had to stay single. But my wife came back for the 100th year anniversary, which was about 30 years after we left, and she said the nicest thing. She said, you always told me that you went up with a great bunch of guys, and she said, I've got to tell you, 30 years later, they're the greatest bunch of guys I've ever met.
Wow.
So that's probably had the most influence on me, actually.
It's just hard to fathom how things happen the way they do, but it worked really well for you. So you went back to South Africa then?
I then went back, and I spent my first 6 months, I was going back to be a registrar, and I was a senior houseman for Professor Schreerer. There were two of us. For some reason, the other senior houseman, he really didn't like him, and he fired him. And he said to me, you'll do the job of two. So I basically came back to Earth. No, never mind the PhD in Oxford. I just spent 6 months admitting 10, 12 patients a day. But I learnt all my auscultatory skills in that 6 months. I don't think there was anything else to learn. He did teach. Huge amount. Then I became a registrar and a consultant after that.
Now, how did somewhere in there you ended up at Mayo Clinic? What was the story from South Africa to Mayo Clinic?
The person that had a great influence on me was Charlie Mullins, who was the chief of cardiology at UT Southwestern before Jim Willison took the job. And he came to South Africa on a sabbatical. And Charlie's just a great guy, and it was wonderful to have him. I can't remember whether he was there for 3 or 6 months. And I got to know him pretty well, and he said he was actually a breath of fresh air, because he'd done a lot of clinical research, and his opinion was, I remember him saying, clinically, I've never seen anything like this place. You know, we all did everything. I ran the CCU, but I cathed my own patients and put in my own pacemakers. I did pediatric cardiology. We did one of my cath sessions was in the, you know, catheterizing little babies. And he said, but you don't have any time for research. And we worked incredibly hard for very little, but the main problem was just academically there was no time, none at all. And there wasn't any encouragement, and there really weren't the facilities. And he said, I think you should come to the States, at least for 5 years or so. And I rode off to a couple of places, sent a CV, but went to Parklands, to UT Southwestern, looking for a job. But at the time, I did say to him, I've heard a lot about the Mayo Clinic through Chris Barnard, and you know, it has a more clinical emphasis, and I think of myself as a clinical cardiologist with an academic interest, but not really as a bench researcher. And he's a great guy, Charlie. He said, I know the chief at the Mayo Clinic. I'll just give him a call. So he called the late Bob Brandenburg, and I got a note from him that said, I'm not the chief anymore. As you know, we rotated Mayo every 8 years. I'm not the chief anymore. The new chief is Robert Fry, and I'll give him your CV. And about a couple of days later, there's a phone call from the States, and it's Bob Fry, and he said, look, I hear you're going to be looking at a number of places in the States. I'd like you to come up and look at the Mayo Clinic. And I think what really attracted me there was, first of all, the clinical standards were so high. Secondly, the databases, the Olmsted County database. I think now, with the large trials and the large registries, it's not the same, but at that time, the Olmsted County database was pretty unique. And I thought I think it's been used epidemiologically, but it's not being used clinically. Right. And then I really saw an opening. And I liked Bob. I mean, Bob Fry has been my mentor and friend for 35 years. I'm the first guy, I'm the first person he hired. And despite that, his career continued to flourish. So I spent this day in March at the Mayo Clinic on a miserable day. And
that must have been an amazing change of climate.
It was an amazing change of climate. And I remember I had, it was midsummer in South Africa, and I had fractured my scaphoid, either playing volleyball or body surfing. I came down, so I had my arm in a cast, a deep South African tan, and the guy said, he'll last 3 months. But at the end of that day, I said to Bob, look, if you offer me a job, I'll take it. And then about a month later, he said, I'm offering you a job. And about a month or two later, I talked to him. I said, I never asked you what I'd be paid. I knew it would be more than in South Africa, so that's why I went there.
How many years have you been at Mayo Clinic now?
I've got to think. It's 78 was when I went there. And then I had about 6-7 years at Georgetown, and then went back to Mayo Clinic. So it's got to be 78, about 25 in total, 22 in total.
Now, we have limited time, but I would like to, a couple of things I want to ask you about for just a quick impression. Chris Barnard was a huge figure in medicine.
He was an extraordinary, extraordinary man. I don't think he was technically a great surgeon, but he really had a great mind. He had the ability to always ask the questions that you didn't think of. So when you'd present cases to him, he'd always come up with a simple question you didn't know the answer to. Sadly, what happened to him, I mean, he was a very good pediatric cardiac surgeon. And in the 1958, Cape Town had a mortality of about 10% for tetralogy repair, which was as good as anything in the world, 10 or 12%. Once he performed the transplant, the fame got to him. And I think he really lost interest. And in the end, it was a sad, lonely death, I think. I knew him when he was really in his prime, and his patients did well, and he was really quite an inspiring man.
So you will come back to Mayo Clinic in sort of closing, because you're still there, but you had that sojourn in Georgetown, and I remember we interacted The late John Eisenberg, who was an amazing person from my view in terms of insight into where healthcare was headed. And Georgetown, it seemed like ought to be like the Mecca of the United States. And
I think, it was a learning experience. I'm not sorry I went. I found it a very stressful 6-7 years. Loved living in Washington, and for all the reasons that I think you enjoy Washington yourself, Rob. And John Eisenberg was an inspiring man who really had a very clear idea, I think, of healthcare policy. And I think the reason, one of the reasons I went was, as you've articulated, and that is, it seemed to be a place that was well poised to take advantages of the changes in healthcare, and Georgetown had struggled, and I think there was a real attempt that maybe this place could be turned around, and I felt that. I think there were several problems endemic to it that I probably hadn't realized, and maybe even the late John Eisenberg hadn't realized. They didn't have the money, and there wasn't the infrastructure, and there really wasn't the strategy. And so what I found difficult to get used to when I came to Georgetown from Mayo Clinic was, number one, the lack of patients. The strength of private practice, which is good competition. I mean, I don't have any problem with competition. But I also didn't, in the end, see any way that we were going to get the patients. I didn't see any strategy of partnering, whether it be with HMOs or whatever. And it really became a day-to-day battle. How were we going to get the patients without the money and without the infrastructure? And finally made the decision that John Eisenberg had already left to go to Agency of Healthcare Quality and Research, Healthcare Policy and Research.
HCPR at the time.
Yeah. And I realized and I knew that the only future for Georgetown was they were going to merge or be bought out. And that if I really wanted to stay in academic medicine, and I needed to go back to an academic institution. So I learned a lot. Very stressful time. Did not get the things done that I would like to have done. There was a period early on, after about 2-3 years, where we had a great faculty and we were publishing a lot. Had some great young people on the faculty who I really enjoyed. Felt awful resigning because I really had to face up to the fact I had recruited them and I was leaving. That was the worst moment in my professional career. Fortunately, not just through me, but one way or another, where they all got well placed. And Georgetown did merge with Washington Hospital Center, and basically now there is no cardiology there. I think there are 2 or 3 cardiologists at Georgetown.
Well, you know, one of the things that's happened at our institution is Bob Lefkowitz got the Nobel Prize.
I saw that yesterday.
In his talks, since getting the Nobel Prize, he's talked a lot about the opportunities that come from failure in the lab. And while it turns out not to be a failure because you learn something and then you go on and do something better. Sounds like that's really what you're saying about your Georgetown experience. A lot of good things happened because of that.
Well, yeah, thank you. I mean, it's a nice way to think about it. I mean, I can't get over the fact that it was also, though, the first time that I tried to do something and I couldn't do it. And I had to come to terms with that. Maybe it's a maturing experience. I'm glad that the really bright young people I recruited are all in good jobs, and that makes me feel better. And I have enjoyed coming back to the Mayo Clinic.
I wish we had a lot more time, but I would like to spend a few minutes on your reflections on the Mayo Clinic. You have deep insight into the past and the future of the Mayo Clinic. A lot of us from the outside admire the Mayo Clinic and then have other feelings about parts of it, about, you know,
well, I think
competition.
There is
a special place.
There is. It is a special place, and there's much to admire. And you come from a great institution and can appreciate the nuances and the differences. There is no doubt that there are differences, I think, between Mayo, Hopkins, partners. The patient comes first at the Mayo Clinic. I mean, we have 3 shields, clinical care, research, and education. But the mission of the Mayo Clinic is patient care, and they deliver it brilliantly. I've been a patient there, and everyone who has wants to come back, and it's a unique place in that way. It's also extremely collegial. think the challenges for everybody in the new environment are formidable. I mean, the majority of our patients still come from the seven states around. And we haven't. We get patients from overseas, but we have not at least built hospitals overseas. Whether the clinic will do this in the future, I don't know. But I think we're all going to be challenged in terms of reimbursement, and it's going to affect Mayo Clinic just like it affects you, what happens to Medicare. There's been a shift. When I went there, a lot of research was actually funded intramurally by Mayo. It was very easy to get a database, get a data coordinator. And several years ago, Gene Brownwald came and did an audit to the cardiovascular division. And his conclusion was that too much research is being funded by the institution and there has to be extramural funding. And that's led to a big shift. And we are funded very well from an NHLBI perspective. But the big challenge is how are we still going to do the clinical research that we're really good at? To what extent is the institution going to support that? Analyzing our own data, our own registries. And I do think that there's great room for collaboration with people like you that do DCRI. Because I think we do bring expertise and you have that priceless wealth of data. And I think we have to do much more with that. I really do. Education, I don't have concerns. Mayo is a great educating institution. But I think we've really got to think very clearly about how we do clinical research and who we partner. So don't think anybody's going to be able to do it on their own.
So if you had to write the formula for the trainee of today, looking at cardiology fellow, looking at the future, what would you say?
I was asked this last night. Some of our fellows prior to the Herrick Award did a blog and said, well, what's the advice you got for the trainees? And I said, well, the one piece of advice I won't give you is what other people tell you, and that is go and find another profession. Because I cannot think of a more satisfying or exciting way to earn a living than to be an academic cardiologist, to take care of patients, to do research, to teach, and to teach not great fellows who give us back as much as we give them. And then the other point I made about it was the ability to interact with friends and colleagues around the world. It's just a wonderful life. I do think the trainee of the future, it's a changing world. I hope that they don't have to subspecialize in cardiology too early. I would hope that maybe the training period there's less general internal medicine and more cardiovascular subspecialization. I encourage trainees to maintain an academic life, and the reason is I think that it's easy to burn out if you're seeing patients 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, and I think that for people, it goes for you and all of us. I mean, I think what's made it so much fun is our lives are so diverse. Seeing patients, doing research, sitting here at the meeting. So I encourage them to, even if they're going to be primarily clinical, but maintain an academic and an educational interest. But it is a changing world, and I'm not sure that any of us know how it's going to turn out.
Well, congratulations, by the way, on the Herrick Award last night. That's a great honor, and it's been a lot of fun for us to get to know you and your wife through various meetings. And that brings up, you know, the last thing is family. You're describing your childhood. It's pretty amazing, but you've got a family of your own.
Well, we're an interesting family. Both my wife and I were married before, so I have a stepdaughter from her first marriage, a son and a daughter who grew up in South Africa in Cape Town from my first marriage, and then we have twin girls, identical twin girls born in Rochester. The family is quite scattered. My stepdaughter is married and lives in Minneapolis, so we see a lot of her and our grandchild. My daughter grew up in South Africa, married an American, an architect, and lives in Oregon. That's another grandchild. My son is still in South Africa, and he's staying there. He had his own business, which he sold, and he's probably looking into, he's really interested in expanding throughout Africa. Africa is an exciting place now. And then the twin girls, amazingly, having gone to different universities, have ended up living within a mile of each other in Jackson Hole, where we have a holiday home. And one is a nurse, the only one doing medicine, and the other one is running a wildlife conservation foundation in Jackson Hole. What is interesting, and I give my wife incredible credit for this, is the five children are very, very close. Close to us, but very close to each other. So the children really do not think of themselves as... they really think of themselves as one family, and they obviously maintain their links with their biological parents. But Anne, who you know, really has played a big role in that.
Well, this has been a really fun interview. I think the audience will love it, and I've learned even more about you than I knew before, so thanks for joining me.